evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Chris George Zuger, and you have entered the Den of Lore. So please grab yourselves a glass of scotch, some single malt blended, whatever you got. Pull a chair up to the fire, and we're going to learn some cool shit tonight. I have a brother of mine, Mr. Alex Francis, on the show. We're kind of, testing him out as far as being a co-host on this show. It takes a lot of work to put this show out every single week, and I want to be able to share this with somebody who's as crazy into this stuff as I am. So please do follow us on Twitter at Den of Lore, visit our website at denoflore.com, and whatever you do, please do subscribe to the channel and support us. Yes, it's going to be a good time. This is episode 3. It is the 12th or the 13th?
13th today.
The 13th of October, 2016. And today we're going to be talking about, Freemasonry, esoteric knowledge, consciousness, possibly some business tips. Alex is quite the journeyman when it comes to knowledge, and I am sure you will all find it extremely interesting now and in the future whenever he decides to come in here. By the way, we're actually doing this live from the studio, so he's a guest in studio with me. And I'm also very thankful that you are all here with us. So without further ado, I am going to switch the graphics. Pacha! There you go.
Who's that handsome man there?
That would be you, I believe.
You do good work on these intros, Chris.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I had to plumb your Facebook for that.
That's all right. That's okay.
Well, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience and make yourself known? Give the people kind of an idea of who you are and what your specialty is and what is it you do.
Specialty. Okay.
Just turn down the intrage music.
My background's in the mechanical world, but I've been doing that for a long time. One of the other things I love to keep myself busy with is just constantly learning about some of the strange and wonderful stuff that's out there in the universe. Plumbing the depths of the rabbit hole, as you and I often call it, Chris.
yes. Well, now, how did you get into the mechanical world exactly? Like, what is your background? Like, you know, even for myself, I'm in advertising. I just saw, like, a commercial out there one day and said, I think I can do that shit. How did you get into doing what you're doing?
Well, I was born with a wrench in the cradle, I suppose. that's some family business stuff going on, so. That always keeps me busy for my day job, but I think we are here today to talk about consciousness and, well, money and business and all kinds of interesting stuff. We'll be jumping all over the map, hopefully keeping you guys entertained.
Oh, well, that's kind of the whole idea. You know, we the last two episodes have run, you know, into the two and a half hour range, but I know that you've got to work tomorrow morning, so we're probably not going to go that late.
Let's see how far we go.
That's good enough. So first of all, again, you're also, not necessarily my lodge brother, but you are a brother.
Yeah.
Let's start out with that and let's compare some Masonic, notes as it were. How did you get into Freemasonry? Everyone's got a different story, but, you know.
Yeah. So about a year ago, I started having a look at, actually a long, long time ago, I started looking into some of the esoteric stuff and have taken an interest in it. And it was I think the turn of, I was about 29 or so, decided to actually take a look at it because I'd seen it on the internet and stuff forever. Before that, I had done, on the tailcoats of a parent of mine, I've gone down and did a bunch of work with some mystery schools and things down in the U.S. through my mother's own exploration into the spiritual world. So I've been overexposed to a lot of New Age spirituality and some of the older occult things as well. I've taken a fair bit of a look at. We can talk about some of that stuff as we get into it, I guess.
Well, this isn't necessarily a...
depends where you want to go with the...
Well,
to start...
We're not really an organized show.
That's okay. We'll just... I'm not going to be able to drink out of this glass boot here. Okay. Thank you.
So, you talked a little bit about the mystery schools. I'm a pure Freemason. Like, I haven't done anything else besides Freemasonry, even though I know, you know, stuff like, you know, the Orange Order or the Order of Buffalo, et cetera, et cetera. So,
okay. I don't know anything about those, but just from digging into the rabbit hole of information, I've just been dabbling and learning a little bit more about Freemasonry more recently. But before that, I had done a bit of study looking at esotericism, and with the mystery schools, talk a lot about Masonry, but you know, start digging into the past. We get into like ancient Sumeria, you get into the origins of religion, the origins of humanity, all those deep and wonderful things in the rabbit hole.
Like, are these types of mystery schools you can't name? Are they that secretive, even more secretive than, like, obviously they don't have like giant neon signs outside their buildings like, you know, Freemasonry does.
No. Well, there was one that was down in Utah that I went to for a couple. There was some seminars and things. It was called the Rocky Mountain Mystery School, which was interesting. It was very multidisciplinary. So they would, you know, Buddhism, Kabbalistic study, more of the classic stuff. Like in Masonry, they talk a lot about Solomon, King Solomon, but they don't go in any real depth with it. And in those mystery schools, they talk about there's like King Solomon healing modalities, and they really go into the depths of religion. One of the things in Masonry that when they're talking about King Solomon, but I find no Masons that I've ever talked to really talk about King Solomon with each other. And there's all sorts of really weird stuff in the path of religion where, like, Solomon was summoning demons and all kinds of magical things. But Masons don't generally talk about those. It's sort of an interesting and odd. Oh. It's like a missing hot topic when you talk to Masons.
Like, well, that's kind of one of the things that they go into in Scottish Rite, where they kind of delve into the whole, at least as far as talking about King Solomon and, you know, the history with the Second Temple and its construction and how it got started. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, the lost word and the lost secrets of a Master Mason. But it's more of an allegorical representation to be able to kind of convey morals, not necessarily an actual historical side of it. So, you know, if you're talking from certain mystery schools, I'm kind of interested to know, you know, exactly how is it they present it, because I'm used to the strictly, you know, this is just kind of used to portray a message, but not necessarily more the other side of it, where it's more the historical or the potentially historical side point, which, you know, I don't know if you want to go into that or if you can go into that. It's,
I guess maybe sort of jumping into an odd, well, maybe a dead end in conversation here, but the King Solomon, if you dig into the history of that, there's something called the Greater Key of Solomon and the Lesser Key of Solomon, which is essentially you're getting into like deep magical type of things with sigils and the whole bit, which is, that's really sort of a really weird offshoot in the history of King Solomon. You can Google that kind of stuff and it'll pop up. There's the documents are all online and stuff, or you can look into that if you're interested in trying to talk to angels or demons and the whole binary light dark paradigm on the world. If you want to dig into that area, you can. One of the things in the Rocky Mountain Mystery School is they talked about Egyptian magic and Enochian magic and Gregorian magic, and they sort of giving you this whole deep hierarchical scheme of the universe. But it's really hard to reconcile. There's so much spirituality and new age spirituality out there. It can be very difficult to try to reconcile your world. I started digging into that stuff when I was pretty young. Always taking it with a grain of salt, but always digging deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole. Never sort of taking it into my own personal belief system, but just giving it some air so you can sort of play with those notions that are outside of everyday consciousness, looking at the world around you.
Well, it, it's not necessarily a dead-end conversation, I'd say. You made a couple good points there when you're talking about, you know, as far as magic's concerned, and again, talking to angels or demons, you know, especially when you start looking at the Gnosticism.
I'm okay to talk about it. It's sort of a jumping into talking about whether you take magic seriously or not. It's sort of an odd place to start, I would say. But
well, you know, this
if
is
you take ritual to its utmost, then what are you really trying to achieve? So if it's masonry or some other order, or, you know, if you're going to a church, what are you doing when you're doing or, you know, practicing some sort of ritual? What are you really learning about the world around you? Are you coming to terms and coming to grips with the physical world and your rationalization, your inner world, in a completely new and different way?
Well, that's the whole point. Like, usually with magic, and again, we talked to Sarai, who we had on last week. We discussed chaos magic.
Okay, interesting. I didn't hear that one.
Well, if you're joining the show, you have to check out the YouTube channel.
I will do that. I'll have to catch up. It's a busy time of year.
Well, Soraya talked about, and he's from Where Did the Road Go, which is a fantastic podcast, been running since 2013. He's also a practitioner of chaos magic, and chaos magic kind of does a lot of the same stuff that you would think from magic, which is to try and manifest something into this world based on, you know, your own free form way of doing it. You know, when dealing with masonry, I've always found that, you know, you'd mention, okay, well, if you're going to church or if you're doing this, what's the whole point? Going back to conversations you and I have had over many glasses of, I'm not sure if it was scotch or whiskey, but, you know, it could have been both. the idea that Freemasonry is meant to, you know, it's meant to help you manifest what you want into this world in a positive way. So.
Yeah, so what I liked about the notion of masonry was well, they talk about the tools. And so you can sort of break things down into first principles and applying principles. So actually, from what I've discovered from it, there's still a lot. How do I put that in a phrase? I'd love to see them talk more about using first principles. You know, there's a lot of metaphors for building and building on yourself and building in the world around you. But I'd love to see them talk more about the principles and the tools and things like that. More of an operative masonry than what I've seen from what I've seen so far, to be honest. So, I had went through a period a while back where it sort of my world had fallen apart a bit, and then the whole like mental operating system in my brain had basically crashed, and they're saying, well, you know, there is no God, or there is a God, or it doesn't matter, or if there is, then, you know, we're living in a giant algorithm of mathematics, and you can start to, you know, fragment pieces of your mental operating system, and then you have to try to pull yourself out of the hole.
Yeah, I've been there.
So, you know, we've all sort of been there in those you have some dark days where you've really sat down to try to reconcile your world, and it doesn't make sense. You know, I've got quantum physics happening, I've got ancient traditions happening, and I've got all sorts of new age spiritualism happening on the internet. And if you dig into it long enough, you end up sort of overexposed, and you're like, okay, this doesn't fit with that, and how am I going to rebuild my world? So I really like the cognitive scientist sort of approach to rationalizing all those different paradigms at the same time. There's a really great film, or not film, but a clip on YouTube from Terrence McKenna where he talks about culture is your operating system. So for the culture is your operating system, he talks about leaving, you know, Johannesburg and going to London. So you're switching from like a super hot city to this foggy place, and it's a completely different culture. It's they just literally, like, you know, you're switching Windows to Mac or to Linux or whatever, back and forth. And if you get to travel around a lot as a speaker or something, then that becomes more apparent to you that there's all these different mental paradigms that are happening all around the world at once. Well, which flavor, you know, which lens do you want to look at the world through today?
Well, that's, you know, it's kind of the same thing if you're dealing with religion. you know, everyone seems to have this claim that they've got the answer towards eternal life, but it's all basically the exact same message. Like, don't be an asshole. Yeah. Across the board, it's just, you know, it comes from different parts of the world, but the core message is the same. It just depends on, you know, what, you know, who is the messenger actually saying it? What's the paradigm behind it? So I always found, at least from a religious standpoint, you know, being able to analyze that and look at that and say, okay, well, you know, this is something that's the same, or this is something I can pull from this, you know, from this faith, or from this religion, or this dogma, and kind of use it to expand my own perception of the world. Yeah. That was kind of one of the reasons I at least got into Freemasonry. It's like, okay, this is something that's new and different, and it kind of says the same thing, but it says it in a different manner. Mm-hmm. You know, that for me kind of flipped the whole...
You got to find something that works, that's going to fit in your head, right? There's... Was it 40,000 different kinds of salvation on this planet? You just have to pick one that you like, so you can go out there and discover all kinds of them.
Or it's, you know, one of those ones where it's like, what happens if it was from, you know, the actual truth about what this world is supposed to be about is from a religion that, like, went extinct 5,000 years ago or some shit, where it's like, oh no, yeah, I know these... You know, the Babylonians, yeah, they wiped them out. Yeah, sorry, you know.
Like, yeah, you sort of start tumbling down the rabbit hole when you spend too much time online, and you boil backwards through Christianity, and you get into some Judaism, and you boil backwards through Judaism, and you get into ancient Egypt. You go backwards from there, then you're into ancient Sumer, and then, you know, everything goes out the window at that point. So you're like, okay, where did, you know, humanity come from? You know, ultimate question.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I'm have always been into like reading Graham Hancock or Robert Schock, where they start talking about where did the origins of our civilization come from,
panspermia, or you know, all those gold conspiracies that are out there for gold mining and the origins of human beings, and alchemy, and there's so many offshoots of that.
Or, you know, whether it was like aliens coming in here to geoengineer humans to be slaves to mine gold, and you know, I've heard it all, and it's just kind of like, okay, so you're saying one thing, but this author says something completely different, and then you've got this author who says you're both full of shit. So, like,
I'm trying to think of the name of the gentleman who's big on that Ubuntu movement.
The Ubuntu movement.
In South Africa. There's a metaphysical lecturer there. Maybe we can pull that up or Google it as we're going through. But he's got some interesting stuff. And then there's some, you know, the monoatomic golds. I don't know if you've tumbled down that rabbit hole or not yet, when they get into alchemy and muriatic acid dissolving gold into monoatomic gold. And
it's supposed to be
monoatomic gold is apparently, you know, super conductive and invisible when you heat it and all these weird things. There's
You know, I saw that YouTube video a couple of years ago.
Yeah. okay, so that sounds like it would be empirical if I had some gold that I wanted to melt in some acid, and you can find the DIYs on how to do that online. Like, that sounds, you know, anytime you can find something empirical that connects you with something that's that ancient, is sort of, it's obviously intriguing.
So. Well, you know, especially when you're dealing with monatomic gold, it's what, like $2,500 an ounce now?
You would just make your own at $1,400. I think $1,400 an ounce plus some acids. Well, one of the weird things that I saw when I was digging into that was they use a muriatic acid, which is not so different from the stomach acid in your body. When they talk about like ancient Egyptians, and they talk about what was it? I'm trying to remember the author's name. They talk about worship and workship. That they used to have in ancient Egypt. There was places where they would create these monatomic golds. And it was a place of workship, not worship. And there were like forges and metal forges that they were using to create the monatomic coppers and monatomic rhodiums and different things like that. And this whole weird notion that the human body can absorb that. And I think that's something that's sort of missing from modern conversation on nutrition, is how is the body actually absorbing the minerals and vitamins and things like that. Lots of people talk about that, but very little is known in terms of the biology of that for 99% of people anyway. I'm sure there's some experts out there.
Well, I would assume that it would kill you, Or at least you would be on the shitter for quite some time.
Yeah, I mean, you're taking multivitamins and there's copper and things like that in there, but no one's ever sat down and said, when was the last time you thought about, okay, what is my body doing with copper or iron and how does all that work? It's there's some interesting mysteries of biology to be had there, particularly with like transmutation of elements. Talk about things like chickens. If you were to measure the inputs and outputs on a chicken, they produce more sodium than they ingest. Just sort of an oddity of science, apparently. Maybe that mystery's been solved. I don't know.
Well, if it's going to be really,
yeah,
that's actually something I have to read.
So then they take things like you know, you weigh the soil for a pot and you put a plant in it and you measure how much, you know, where's all the mass of the plant coming, because you take the plant out of the soil like 20 years later and there's the same weight for the soil that was originally there. So there's some interesting magic, if you will, and built into nature. One of the things that I got interested in more lately was the urban farming movement.
We
talk
yes.
about biology and leveraging nature is a really interesting topic, particularly when it comes to financing your retirement. To sort of swing this out of metaphysics and into finance or whatever for a minute. Leveraging nature was a really interesting thing. I got into trying to, if I can swing the conversation somewhere else for a minute here, into trying to figure out the
you can swing it anywhere you want. That's
retirement math. I was sitting down. You and I were sitting down. Actually, when we were talking about retirement mathematics and getting to the, you know, the $1 million and compound interest, and you know, a bunch of old farts sat around in a room hundreds of years ago and said, "You like compound interest? I like compound interest. Let's make the entire human society run on compound interest." And this notion that someone in our generation would flip that on its head. The way that human beings are doing math, and we're living in a world right now where we've got, you know, quantum computing coming out, and you know, half the world in debt with mortgages. It's sort of to an insane degree. You say, well, okay, well, I'm never going to hit this $1 million unless I learn how to leverage things. I have to apply my principles. You know, I have to apply particular tools of expanding my means all the time in order to try to get to where I need to go. So how can I do that? Well, leveraging nature is a key thing in that, I think.
The other way is to just elope. Don't actually pay for a big wedding because...
No, I'm switching into weddings. Yeah.
Just, well, I'm color commentating. So
fair enough.
Yeah. Well, letting nature work for you. Leverage the cycles and the processes that have been built over billions and billions of years to kind of, you know, help you make money. That's kind of that's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, I think the last time you and I had met, we were in that bar, and I don't know if I had shared that harebrained idea I had with you, which is, because if you want to hit your $1 million, well, you're doing your 7% compound interest if you're following the generic investing route or whatever, hoping you get 7% solid for the next 50 years, which is a little insane. And I started to try to explain some of the investing stuff to one of my brothers, actually. And so we drew out a graph and mapped out, you know, your ROIs on one axis, and the different kinds of ideas all got plotted in terms of percentage returns and stuff like that. So you'd sort of map out the universe around you and say, well, you know, I can do GICs and I will get 3%. Or I can do this business or that business. Maybe I'll get 30%. But the idea of leveraging nature, so you can go online and you can buy 22,000 seeds of lettuce for $8. And if you had the room to plant it, or you knew somebody else that had the land, even if you don't have the land, you could plant all of those and you'd have $3 a head for lettuce. You'd make $66,000 minus your $8 you originally put into all of those seeds. And you'd have something like a 7,500% return on investment.
But what
that's
about
in 60 to 90 days? When was the last time you made $50,000 in 60 to 90 days? Those, you know, farmers blackjack out there buying multi-million-dollar John Deere, you know, combines and stuff with no math going behind them, and nobody in school taught you how to do that, how to leverage nature.
No, in school I learned how to do insider trading. That was kind of my thing.
Yeah. The stock market's good, yeah, as long as you don't hit any losses. You can keep compounding.
Oh, no, no, I hit losses. I hit losses.
Yeah. I took a technical trading course once that was pretty interesting. They teach you how to read the, you know, MACDs and fast stochastic indicators and set yourself up. And I'd pulled a whole bunch of the money out of the mutual funds and got, instead of 7% in a year, I was getting 7% in a week, which is basically one tick or 1% per day. can catch something on an upcycle and read the graphs properly. A little bit nauseating. You know, you can try to get into day trading if you want to go extreme, but it's a little bit like standing in front of a subway watching watching the train go by inches from your face. So you don't want to do that every day, and you don't want to be so lax with it that you're getting 7% a year. But if you can get 7% in a week, I figured that was sort of the sweet spot in investing, where you could maybe hop in and out of a trade in a week. If you could do that 30 times in a row, well, you'd have your retirement fund.
Well, why haven't you looked into like doing real estate, obviously?
I have. I just need to get the seed money, which is where the lettuce idea notion comes from.
Pun intended, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Literal seed money. So that sort of circles back on the whole notion of germination, which was interesting. So I tried to get in the backyard and gardens and stuff going this year at my place, which was fun and interesting. But I learned a lot about germination, getting the seeds to grow and the temperatures and soil and how long things take. And there's a whole urban farming movement right now that's sort of caught my eye lately, which is interesting. They say less than 1% of Canadian farmers are under the age of 35, which is bad news for our country. We are going to be importing a lot of food unless we learn how to change that and Canadians learn how to leverage nature. I imagine, maybe not everyone's going to get into farming because Canada's so bloody cold, but...
Have you been to Regina?
No, I have not. But lettuce does grow in the cold.
Well, that's kind of...
So I have a chance. Let's see.
Make some green with some green.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember that you...
The commodities market has returned.
Well, I remember that you had, and again, at this point, most of our listeners are probably thinking, oh, that Chris guy is a freaking alcoholic, but that's because every single time I talk about something, I'm like, I was probably very drunk when that happened. But I remember when you tried to explain it to me the last time, I'd probably had a couple of drinks in me during the 4 or 5 hours that you had hit me with all the numbers, and I was probably just having a bad day at that point anyway, but still, it seemed quite viable. Now, like, why do you think one of the big things... is behind the lack of people under 35 getting into farming? Like, is
it's looked down upon, just like plumbers are looked down upon. There's, I'm well aware of that in the HVAC industry that I'm in. The plumbers, the electricians, the top of the pile, and plumbers at the bottom of the pile in terms of desirability for the jobs. There's a whole stigma attached. Grown up with the bad press of the plumbers with their ass cracks hanging out as they're working under a sink or something like that. Sort of looked down on society. I blame advertising for that.
Oh, well, that's fantastic.
those stereotypes propagating badly for some of the trades. The trades need to be overhauled in terms of the way that the marketing is done. And I think it's starting to. So,
well, especially now with the economy kind of going to crap the last decade, I know that there's been a big push with, especially with second careers, to bring people more towards trades. I know a few people who've gone through the HVAC program here in Ottawa, and they're doing quite well for themselves.
I was down in Toronto once for the Canadian Mechanical Expo, and there's a little video somewhere online of that. But they're talking about what can we do to change the stereotype of the plumbers. And I said, well, the best thing you could do, you'd show an advertisement of a plumber rolling up to Google, and there's a plumbing line burst over top of their computer servers, and there's water going everywhere. The plumber rolls up with his ass crack hanging out, but he's rolling up in a Ferrari or something. All the IT guys are scratching their heads. You throw that on TV, you start reversing those. If you can't hide if you can't hide it, advertise it,
just to get the idea where it's like, yeah, this, he may have his ass crack out, but every single plumbing situation just turns out into a porn. Just like,
I'm pretty sure everything's turned into a porn nowadays.
No, I know. But still. If we're trying to be able to get people back into the trades, that's at least one or two potential ways to be able to do it. I personally think my way is quite hilarious, but it's obviously your way to be a little bit more realistic. With the exodus from farming, Canada, even with global warming, we're looking at an exponential increase in potential growing area or growing space.
Yeah, one thing I thought was an interesting notion, getting into commodities. So when I started digging into a little bit of the technical trading stuff, one of the gentlemen had actually hired on, a professional accountant who was down in the States, and I did a little bit of coaching sessions with him for about half an hour to an hour a week, learning how to try to navigate the technical trading world, which is a big world. And I got into the commodities a little bit, and we were chatting about the Chinese are trying to buy the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and get into owning the commodities market. So I guess if the U.S. currencies are... the U.S. economy is in the shits, then China wants to own the commodities instead of the U.S. dollars. I thought that was an interesting notion he and I got into. But when you go towards the retirement goals, you'd say, well, what is wealth? What do I really need? Is it money that I need when I'm 70 years old, or is it friends and family and good food? So you can sort of hack your way around getting the numbers to grow that you want. I was having a conversation with a gentleman the other day, and there was a notion of our generation doesn't have as much money as the previous generations. Most of the money in the economy is sitting in older people's pockets, or their GICs, doing not a lot of investing at the moment. So you'd say, well, okay, so how are we going to generate those? How are we going to generate those returns that we need? Where was I going with that? Well, we were just talking about 10 seconds before that. That was...
Global warming.
Oh, commodities markets. Excuse
yes.
me.
Yes.
Yeah, so how are you going to generate a spread? Well, you could sort of boil the entire economy down to first principles. You'd say, well, either you're leveraging nature or you're doing arbitrage. So whenever you're in a distributor model, if you're Walmart or whatever, they're not manufacturing. They're just buying an apple at a dollar or selling it for $1.05. They're getting a 5-cent spread. It's just you have this sort of a triangular transaction that's happening. But when you look at the people who've really, really made it in the world, your Rockefellers or your oil giants and stuff like that, they're leveraging nature. So going out into nature, nature's not charging you anything other than your setup or infrastructure, but you're taking oil out of the ground and for, $0 or the cost to build your rig and selling at $40 or $50 a barrel or whatever. Obviously, there's a pretty crazy spread when you're leveraging nature. So that's an important principle to remember. You can boil out a lot of the noise and the details of the economy, and you sort of come down to these couple fundamental notions.
But at the same time, you're talking about the difference between, let's say, oil or...
Doesn't matter what the commodity is, copper or wheat or pork bellies or whatever it is.
Truffles.
The mathematics of it is the same. It's just I have an object and you have some money and there's a spread on everything. It's just how can I get enough spread? Warren Buffett has a really interesting book on special situation arbitrage, which is essentially looking for zero risk investments. So where can I get a zero risk investment? Well, I have insider knowledge or something like that. If I know company A, B, C is going to buy company X, Y, Z and a month from now, and they're going to buy it at $13 and it's currently $10. So you can see there's a $3 spread there. There's legally binding contracts that help regulate that sale because it's all done in advance. There's a fair bit of predicting, predictable, not that it's a perfect thing, like nothing's ever completely without risk, but... yeah, you want to know where you can find those zero-risk returns when you're trying to do your investing. So you'd say, well, when I'm 65 and I'm sitting on $1 million because I made it or whatever, then I'm going to have to know how to invest that $1 million. So are you really going to be smarter at knowing how to invest $1 million when you're 65 than you are right now? So if you had $1 million to invest right now, hypothetically, what would you be doing with it to make sure you get your 4, 6, 7% return or better? And there's basically sort of three markets for that. You can do your real estate investing, you can do your private equities markets, or you can do your public markets. And most of your octane comes from your business or your real estate. The public markets are there, but they're obviously riskier. You don't have as much control when you look at like a risk management profile for your investing.
Well,
we're getting into finance here.
Yeah, no, I'm just trying to think if I should just like keep you, you know, keep you around while I'm trying to build up my RSPs.
Sure, I would suggest business. Obviously, then you can get into this notion of you know, money per unit time. So when you do start getting into some of the retirement planning notions, you're going to learn how to read the financial reports and things like that, and they don't teach you that in school unless you specifically focused on it. But then you get awash, you get hit with trying to do your due diligence of all these companies. You're reading into the reports and you're just getting hit with, you know, tsunami after tsunami of numbers. So then you say, well, okay, you know, I don't want the numbers anymore. The numbers are meaningless. Whether a company does a million or 10 million, it doesn't, you know, what are their operating expenses versus the revenue? And so everything becomes a ratio. So then you're boiling everything down into ratios. And the ratios you can plot on a linear scale of, you know, hot to cold or 1 to 10 or whatever. So you can plot those ratios onto a scale, and that gives you a key performance indicator. Is it green? Is it red? And so really you're always looking for key performance indicators. It's a better way of looking at the world. And if you talk to, you know, high-level accounting firms and stuff like that to help try to run your business, they're always looking at the metrics. And the metrics are, you know, half of the formulas that exist. So, you know, there's always the dividing line. And the dividing line is really giving you the relativity of different concepts, you know, A to B, you know, three quarters of this and half of that, whatever. It's when you look at the, you know, you want to understand the formulas of the world more so than, you know, just where the numbers are.
Well, that's a much more.
That's, you know, the rich get richer, and, you know, the economy is slanted towards the people that are in the know for the formula. So it doesn't matter if you take all the money away from somebody. If they're brilliant, they'll know how to tweak the formulas back into their favor. It's all about creating asymmetrical risk, you know, in all kinds of investing. And the best way to do that is, you know, there's the legal contracts and things that all the old boys know.
Now, how does this lead back into you growing lettuce?
Lettuce, you'd say, well, money per unit time is a very important principle. So you could walk into McDonald's and you see somebody and, you know, they're making $8 or $10 an hour or whatever it is. And you're never going to approach that person and say, hey, you're never going to retire at McDonald's. They know that. It just makes you an asshole if you talk to them about it. But, you know, some part of you, I wish that someone would come up to me when I was that young and say, look, what you're doing is not very smart yet. You know, you need to see that there's discrete mathematics here. You know, you don't want to hit some young person with a sense of fatalism saying, hey, you know, you're going to be dead when you're 80 and you need $1 million because you're going to be old and tired and no one's going to hire you anymore. So you better have your money working for you. And the only way to get that much money is to use leverage. And what are these principles of leverage that I need to learn? Well, I need to learn how to leverage other people's money. I need to learn how to leverage other people's time and leveraging other people's experience. Or for farming, I leverage other people's land if I don't have it. So you could have a GUI or a dashboard in your head for how you're structuring and looking at the paradigm of your world around you. You would want those indicators for, like, right up on your dashboard if you're on top of your game every day. So did I leverage somebody else's money today? That's the whole thing about the real estate scheme. And those principles of leverage can be used for good or bad. You can say, well, you know, this landlord is a slumlord and they're just, you know, they're going to take that person who's, you know, they're renting that house and they're not going to hit any equity in the house. Or how is that person going to retire? And there's this sort of dark path you can take with the notion of that. Or you can flip it around and say, well, I'm giving value to that person who's renting the space. They don't want to be in that house forever. They need a roof over their head and they need warmth and blah, blah, blah. And I'm offering all these good things. So you can sort of pitch which direction you want to throw that principle. And you can do the same with the other principles too. So, you know, other people's time. So nobody likes when someone's wasting their time. Every time you're working for somebody on a, you know, dollar per hour type basis, well, you're selling your time. You only get so much time in life. So then you say, well, how do I leverage other people's time? Well, am I leveraging other people's time for good or for bad? That's actually an interesting way to kind of razor through some of the conspiracies and things that are out there in terms of people, you know, controlling the world or the way that the tax system and the mathematics of our society is set up. It's, you know, you have to learn how to leverage other people's time. You have to learn how to work as a team to make big things happen for yourself. You need a team to do that. You can't do it by yourself. And they don't really teach you that. But when you get into, okay, how do I make money? Well, every time I made money I always made it from helping somebody else. I'm not printing dollars here. The only way I get money is from other people, essentially. So every time I've helped somebody else, that's how I've gotten my money. You say, well, okay, how can I help more people? How do I leverage? How do I get that multiplying factor on a per unit time basis? Am I still going 1 to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1? Or have I improved my game and now I'm doing 1 to 100 or 1 to 1,000, or I'm printing books or something where I'm reaching a much wider audience? And in order to do that, then I have to work on myself to become worthy of the stage. And that's a really important process in the whole self-development thing.
Now,
public speaking and actually having some genuine insight on some subjects.
Yeah, that's kind of, well, kind of one of the reasons why I got this show going, at least.
Reach a wider audience, yeah.
Well, you know, that's also just kind of something fun to do. It's a reason to have a glass of scotch on a Thursday night. Talk to some interesting people. But from the standpoint of the stage, like, you know, having insight, is public speaking something that you've wanted, you know, you want to look at doing at some point? And no. Let's say...
Not particularly, no.
Well, you know, if you're dealing with speaking fees, I know some of those fees are astronomically high, so, you know, that's a good idea to, you know, talk for an hour and give a lecture, and then, boom, here's like $100,000.
And it's not a problem if it's astronomically high, as long as you can get the return on it. So if somebody's connecting you, they're acting as the multiplier for your content, then that has value. And so, you know, people do it all the time. If it's a, you know, you can hire a girl on Instagram who's a yoga pant model to show off your new gym bag or your new running shoes or something like that. So they've got the following and you've got the product, and you got to add those two pieces together to make a business and marketing go at it, right? There's nothing wrong with that. It's just you're playing a different kind of marketing leverage. Marketing's, you know, it's all impressions per dollar and those kinds of metrics.
So what you're saying is for this show, what we need to do is put some Den of Lore t-shirts on
denoflooryogapants.com. Or, you know, whatever you want to do with it. Get the attention, right?
Well,
that's actually sort of led back to that notion that I had almost slipped out of my mind a couple minutes ago, which was the idea of social capital. I'm not the original to coin that phrase, but they say, well, our generation doesn't have very much money. So what am I going to do when I earn that money? I'm going to go out and buy some sort of status item, and then I'm going to use the status item to try to get attention. And the attention is really a form of social capital. So in the world of endless marketing, when I'm constantly being bombarded with ads, then you say, well, those impressions matter. And our generation can try to circumvent the money problem and just get social capital and social recognition from other people. That's why things like Facebook are so, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those social media platforms are so prevalent. They say, well, you know, if you think of it sociologically, it's our generation circumventing the money problem. So I can go out and get recognition just by doing a fancy post on YouTube or something like that. You know, you can be dirt poor and have a Facebook stream with 1,000 people on it, or 100,000 people on your Instagram following or whatever. You don't have to actually have money to be famous or get that sense of social recognition anymore. Our generation sort of hacked around that problem.
Well, that and YouTube ads, like a lot of YouTube channels that I've seen, that they've started out very, very small, and that's kind of one of the things I don't want to get into, as far as, you know, at least it's kind of that chicken and the egg. It's like, okay, if you want to make money, but you don't want to kind of impact the user experience. But I've seen people who don't really care, and they just kind of go right towards the, okay, I've hit 1,000 followers or 10,000 followers or 50,000 followers, and all of a sudden they've got ads in every single one of their YouTube videos, just because they know they're going to get 100,000 hits on every single show.
In the marketing, they always play the numbers, and they say, well, 3% of the market is looking for your product at any one time. Only 3%. So yeah. They did like tests with audiences and stuff like that. I'm paraphrasing this from some sales book that I read, but and if you had 100 people in the audience and you stood up on stage and say, well, you need product XYZ, and three people would raise their hands. We're like, okay, you know, how many people are looking for a car right now? Well, 3% of the 100 would raise their hands. How many people need, you know, a new computer or whatever? 3%. So anyway, there's some interesting demographics for marketing there, but you don't have to necessarily feel guilty if you're offering something of value. You know, just make your message clean and concise, and you shouldn't feel guilty or not participate in the economy because you have good content and you need to, you need to support yourself to create those shows and make your world work, right? Marketing's part of that.
Well,
just doing it ways that are clean.
Well, that's the hard part. Well, that's why, like, I'm looking at getting the swag store going at some point, and offering at least an actual viable product that can be provided, so people can actually say, hey, I listen to the show, and get something cool and awesome out there. But for the amount of for the amount of viewers, the top end for this type of show, unless I'm Joe Rogan Experience, which at some point it'd be nice to get up to that level, but I'm not famous getting into this. But Joe Rogan Experience, gets 200,000 hits, in a day. The top end for this type of podcast gets probably around maybe 6 to 10,000, and but for me, it's mostly just about the kind of.
You got to keep the show going. Got to keep this show on the road, they say.
Well, I already have all the equipment. That's kind of the whole thing. I got the equipment. I got the room. And if it's being done in the afternoons or the evenings, it's not really that much of a thing. This is it's a hobby that I want to be able to turn into something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Whether people listen or not, or 50 people listen to one episode, or 500 listen to an episode.
You got to get the multiple streams of income working in your favor.
Well, that's kind of it, but it's more of a nice to have, mm-hmm. It's a feather in my cap to be able to say I'm doing something that I love. Yeah. If I can make a little bit of cash off of it, that's great. But the whole purpose behind the show is to make sure that we as individuals don't, one thing to be able to participate in the economy, but I know the pitfalls and the annoyances between most other shows. I spent a year analyzing most other shows as far as what kind of content they have and how they present the product. There are shows that do very, very well that have commercials every 15 to 20 minutes. I still find it as annoying as hell. There's ones that have commercials in the beginning and then straight content like we're doing right now until right to the end. Then you've got ones that have no commercials whatsoever. Between the second and the third one, that's the type of show that this may actually kind of end up being. But I don't want to have a commercial break every 15 minutes, because then you're cutting into the action. Well, what happens when we've got, let's say, the biggest kind of lost civilizations guy on the planet, who's mm-hmm. kind of walking into the, not necessarily, maybe he's actually here in studio.
I'd say you'd have to make your margin, and you don't have to feel guilty about that in business. You have to be around. So I'd say to customers often that are doing equipment orders or things with us, what is a reasonable margin? So maybe one day in the future, everyone will be transparent with how their businesses and their overhead costs and things like that would work. Utopian society, we'd be like, okay, I'm going to ask you for 10% over all these material and labor costs and things like that, and you're okay with that because I've given you a good service and you're happy with the results. There's a great audiobook by Ayn Rand called Why Businessmen Need Philosophy, and she's got some very interesting notions. I'd recommend it for everyone I meet usually. She says, well, if a business person is... you're charging less than your competition, well, then you're a cutthroat. And if you're charging more than your competition, then you're twisting the knife and you're greedy. And if you're charging exactly what your competition is charging, well, then you're colluding. So no matter what you do, society basically calls you a bad person when you're in business. You're trapped. So that's why you need philosophy to be a business person or to be a business owner.
Well, the philosophy here is drink scotch, learn cool shit.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you want to learn and you want to apply. That's the tricky part, is getting all those things rolling and systematizing. So the whole e-business thing is supposed to be very good at systematizing that. If you do it properly, then it's not going to eat up too much of your day. You're not going to have to spend the rest of your days packing up, Denivlar sweaters and bringing them down to the post office and shipping them out. I mean, that's going to be fun to do, but if you started doing hundreds of it, then you're going to need help and a team, and all those business principles come into action, right?
At least now, I know people that have done, like they've gotten into business, like e-vape. Vaping shops that they've started up, and they do all drop shipping. You know, where they, let's say, they've got stuff coming in from China, they've got a warehouse out in Vancouver.
So you're doing an arbitrage, and then you're leveraging other people's time, which is essentially your drop shippers. So that's the model.
So, well, that's kind of how they got started. Now they actually have retail stores. Like, they just opened those up in the last 2 years, which I think is pretty cool. You know, I don't think I've got the room for that, but from a business standpoint, it's like, you know, I just kind of want to just, like, you know, grow some lettuce.
What's a worthy product, right? What does the rest of society value? You could grow all kinds of crops and you get an amazing return on investment when you do the math on it. But if nobody's buying your lettuce, then you're, you know, shit out of luck. So you always have to apply, you have to pander to what society wants. And so that sort of circles back on the notion. So every dollar you make is from only when you're helping somebody else. And that's the way the economy should run.
Well,
in principle, right?
Well, yeah, in principle. But...
Or the way that it does. It's just you don't think about it that way. Then it's all, you know, one big algorithm. How can I help the most people in the shortest period of time? You can plot those ideas out on a graph or on a piece of paper. Actually, one of the interviews where they're talking with Elon Musk about his whole Mars thing or whatever, to take this on another wild outer space tangent, he had talked about that. So he's, you know, where can I help? Where can I impact the most people? And, you know, what's of the greatest value to other people? And you sort of map out your ideas, put them on a chart.
Just kind of go towards there and see what you can actually accomplish. And now he's like, okay, well, how can I affect the most people? We're apparently going to Mars by 2026 or 2050. You know, a million people by 2060. And I think at Mars by 2020, which I think is insane. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, here's a video, and it's the 3D model. And by the way, the ship's going to look exactly like this, pretty much, kind of. And, you know, they're trying to bring the launch or the trip down to about, like, $200,000 per person, apparently. Yeah. Or something insane like that.
Quarter million to go to Mars for your retirement. I had a friend of mine who crashed on my couch for a couple of weeks because he was job transitioning, whatever. And he wanted to be a comedian. I said, well, the perfect setup for a whole comedy show, and I've never heard anybody do it, is how are we going to populate Mars? And there's so many racist and hilarious comments that you can throw into that. Like, who should we send? Or like, oh, we can send the Chinese because they'll finally have a safe place to drive. You know, you can, you know, insert Mexican joke, insert Caucasian joke, or whatever, any stereotype you want, just throw it into the Mars context. I've never seen a comedian do that.
No, nope.
I'd love to help write the script.
Well, you know, Russell Peters may call you. I don't know of any Caucasian comic that would get away with that without getting shot.
Jim Jeffries is coming to Ottawa soon. He's a racy enough comic for that. Maybe I'll, I might actually. You and I should go to this show. I think it's coming up this spring. I think it's about $130 a ticket or something like that.
Holy,
he's a great comedian. Much more expensive than his last show in Ottawa, which I didn't see. My brother went to it, but he's a very, very funny comedian.
Well, I'll start saving my pennies.
Hmm.
Now. I'm gonna check and see what this book is here you've got here. So this is the Shamanistic Path to Quantum Consciousness, The Eighth Circuits of Creative Power by Laurent Duguillet. I can't even pronounce his last name.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting. I actually have only partially started to read into the book, but we brought it as potential subject matter here. Eight circuits of consciousness. So that was a whole sort of mental paradigm that Timothy Leary had developed, I think, while he was in prison. If you read through the book, Timothy Leary was a psychonaut. Back in the '60s, he was going around Harvard University giving all the graduate students acid and stuff like that, and getting them to try to open up their consciousness. And hated by Nixon, very controversial figure. But he and this other psychologist type, probably not a psychologist, but Robert Anton Wilson and Timothy Leary had basically been the forerunners of this Eight Circuits of Consciousness theory. And it's basically, they said, well, there's different layers to the inner mind and the inner world and the outer world, and you can start to try to map out what enlightenment would look like in steps. which is an interesting interesting notion. So you could say, well, level one consciousness is you are a glorified meat tube, just eating and excreting and very basic consciousness. And level two consciousness, you get into your emotional body. And level three consciousness, you get into this social hierarchy kind of thing, you know, alpha, beta, dominant, submissive, all these human hierarchical, you know, they say the best way to discuss politics is on all fours. You know, who's sniffing whose ass, who's trying to, you know, do who or whatever in politics. And then you go up at the levels or the ladders in this eight circuits of consciousness model, and you get to higher states of consciousness, so social consciousness and transcendental consciousness and sort of a mystical consciousness. And a lot of the grudge and the hard thing in society is switching gears. So you could say, well, I'm going to be up on a mountain meditating like a monk for the next 6 months. But what am I really doing for the world once I achieve enlightenment if I'm not coming back down off the mountain and sharing it with the people? You'd have what they call monk's pride, which doesn't do anybody any good except maybe you if you're into mental masturbation of meditating all day long. But you haven't actually achieved much for the physical world anyway. So you have to sort of gear shift. You can't just stay in sixth gear. You have to come back down and park in the real world. And so it's this drudgery of going back and forth between the different states of consciousness that really gives people a lot of anxiety. Say, well, I wake up in the morning and I'm going to sit there and think happy thoughts and meditate. But then I have to get in my car and drive through rush hour traffic and go to a place and help other people and not work on myself anymore, but work on helping other people so that I can, you know, eat and participate in the economy. And to do that, so the whole thing with Timothy Leary, they said, well, there's different kinds of meditative paths and there's different kinds of drugs and things that you can force yourself into a particular state of consciousness. So, you know, if you can't get there, as McKenna says, on the natch, or just, you know, shifting gears into it, you can force yourself into a state of consciousness. You know, LSD would change your consciousness against your will in a heartbeat, right? Or you can try to meditate and achieve a similar state of consciousness without the drug. So for instance, a lot of people depend on, you know, they say, well, level two consciousness or three consciousness, you're trying to dominate the world around you. I'm trying to physically go out and do stuff. I'm going to go out and farm. I'm going to manipulate matter, as opposed to just sit on my couch and look at the clouds with my brain. And you say, well, if I'm going to go out and dominate the world, then there's a particular state of consciousness that I need to be in for that. So they say, well, in the book, he talks about coffee and cocaine being right next to each other. They're both drugs that make you want to dominate the world around you. That drug helps change the mind, and the neurology of the mind helps shift your awareness into that particular state of consciousness. So it's very useful. You know, before I go jump in the car, I'm going to throw back a huge cup of coffee, and I'm committing to switching gears because, you know, not only do I need to go there with my conscious mind, but I'm going to go there, you know, with the assistance of the coffee caffeine drug to get me into that state of mind. And then they say, well, you know, level four consciousness is social consciousness. So the drug of choice there would be something like MDMA, where you're in love with everybody. You know, you're thinking about society at large and these grand notions, and you're opening up your heart and things to all these different people. And, you know, a drug can kind of force you into that mental state, or you can just meditate yourself into that mental state once you're aware of that, and you can kind of hang out in that. So they talk about, you know, sort of individual people's consciousness as well as where society is at as a whole. Basically say, well, society is at level four consciousness right now. There's a few people that have learned how to switch into sixth or seventh gear into going into transcendental consciousness. And say, well, you know, you and I are just sitting here in a room, but we're also, you know, meat popsicles sitting on a rock flying through the universe at 20,000 kilometers an hour. It's a radically different paradigm. And we've got air pressure, and we've got gravity, and we've got heat, and we've got 10,000 different kinds of microwaves and things passing through our body simultaneously. It's how much paradigm do you want to load into your head? You know, or you can just be like, I'm just me here, you know, eating as a meat tube, eating and excreting, very basic. So you're going to run the gamut back and forth between those different states of consciousness throughout the rest of your life. So if you have a modality or a way to try to map out the landscape, or, you know, a map of the landscape of your mind, you know, there's no perfect model, but you've at least tried to lay out a good model to try to put all that stuff in perspective or a relative perspective for other people. it's a really cool book that I'm definitely enjoying. I recommend it.
Now, how did you get into this type of like more like just, you know, consciousness shifting subject? Because even for myself, like again, I'm probably just like a meat tube sitting here, you know, on a podcast.
Some days we all are. Right?
But what made you want to like get into this type of subject matter?
Too much time on the internet, to be honest. Canada's quite cold, so when you're not, you know, snowboarding or something, you're going to sit in and read. And if you're reading online, then you're going to go where your interests take you. So for me, that was often, you know, down the rabbit hole, looking at some weird and zany stuff. And whatever blows your hair back, right? That's where you're gonna try to read. I always like the cognitive sciences model. I went into university doing business admin, but I'd also had gotten a scholarship to do cognitive sciences at the other university in town, but I never took it, but it always stayed an interest in my life.
That's kind of along the lines of, I'm going to say, like Graham Hancock, who he's shifted, like he was a journalist when he started out, got, you know, he was doing war correspondence in Ethiopia, and then he started getting into like more of the esoteric, you know, the ancient history and stuff like that.
Graham Hancock is, I enjoy him as an author. I've only read a bit of his stuff. I've seen more of his podcasts and online material, but I'd love to run around the ancient world and go on adventures and stuff like that. A little more on the Tomb Raider side of things than an anthropologist, but there's definitely some awesome notions there. And it's always mind-bending because you're sort of, when you dive into those ancient rabbit holes, you're saying, well, if I find anything interesting here, it's going to give me grounds to help the rest of society like completely reconcile or, you know, change their notion of human history. That's a very powerful thing that you're after.
Well,
for other people or for yourself. That's why you dive into those holes, right?
The other flip of the coin for him is the talk of consciousness. I know that he's mentioned, you know, let's say going on like ayahuasca trips and talking and essentially expanding your mind to the point where you can actually get in contact with other beings, or it's like you're you know, if there's aliens type of things, these are probably the ones that we want to be able to talk to, because they're like, oh shit, now you like, we're glad you can actually talk to us and see us now. This is great.
If there's other dimensional beings out there, there's good ones and there's bad ones, and there's going to be a whole spectrum.
Is this subject matter more toward like still kind of in parallel to that, or is it?
Yeah, well, you could say, well, you know, ayahuasca or ibogaine. I've looked at those a bit. I've had a couple of friends that have gone down and done ayahuasca trips down south. I think Peru, and I've sat with them on my couch, and they've told me the, you know, firsthand stories of doing it. It was really profound for them. It's something that's been of interest for me, but I've never gone. So you could say, well, if you were to go down there and you were to administer some drug to change your consciousness, you know, what are you going to get out of it? What are you going to do with the results, as opposed to just having a profound insight? Profound insight is great, but if you don't actually apply it to your life, then it can actually get painful after a while once you start accumulating enough knowledge. And if you don't apply the knowledge that you've learned, you feel like you're not doing your job in life anymore.
Yep, yeah, I know the feeling.
That kind of hits you, and I think we're prone to that because we spend a lot of time digging around down those rabbit holes trying to learn these beautiful, insightful things to help keep us inspired. You know, we're not just meat puppets flying on a rock, eating and excreting. You know, you have to be inspired while you're here at the profound nature of the universe. What's that fun line? Simplicity is absurdly a profundity. Just depends where your head is at. Nothing is really simple.
Now, so switching gears here just a little bit, going back to like towards the ancient history stuff, and again, maybe I'm just going after my third or fourth dram at this point, but ancient history, you know, is kind of like one of the big things that I'm like really into, especially dealing with antediluvian history. Anything that's concerning, you know, Atlantis, Mu, Lemuria, any of that. What is your give me your take on the potential, you know, the prehistory history of humanity. What is your take on that?
I think there's some profound things that we're going to discover down the history rabbit hole. I mean, you could go back and, you know, you're looking at Egypt and the pyramids. Well, I don't think they called Egypt Egypt back when they were building the pyramids. There's a, you know, somewhere in there, there's a dramatically different worldview that those people were living with. And there's all kinds of buried things still to be found. You and I were chatting one time about, okay, Chris, we need to go on more adventures here. We need to get out of our heads and out into the jungle or go do something fun.
And we're stuck in Ottawa, so we have to leverage the lettuce to get tickets so we can actually go.
We can do this.
Well, you know
what? Apply your principles.
I will help you grow it if you get the tickets.
And we'll go on a trip to Atlantis. I'll rent the submarine.
Bahamas? That's awesome.
Where is it? Yeah, there's a lot of notions on where that is and what.
Oh no, I was talking about the casino resort.
There's that too. Yeah, I don't know where to. I mean, I don't know where to place my bets on that. You know, is it part of my? I guess it doesn't matter if it's part of your belief structure or not. It's just, you know, where is the evidence? If it's there and somebody finds it, I imagine it will come out into. Mainstream media, if they find a deep sea underwater city, and there's still a lot to be found in the world. Ancient Lemuria and Mu, I've heard of them. It's ancient cultures and things. It's too far back for me to really have an opinion on New Age movements and things like that. Talk about them a fair bit. They haven't caught my attention too much. And there's people looking at crystals and keeping memories and crystals and moo, and it's all pretty, that segment of the metaphysical rabbit hole is a little hazy in my mind, to be honest. I don't know much about those.
Well, it's also one of those, you can't discount it because it was potentially so long ago, but you can't without a doubt, shadow of a doubt, say yep, that's the way it happened, because then you're like jumping on the bandwagon. It's one of those.
Nobody's got the truth on that. Nobody.
Yeah. Well, we may be talking to some people who have had, past life regression, who have maybe visited those lands. So it's something at least to be able to keep an open mind about. I'm of the mind that as long as it's interesting and as long as it somehow at least kind of expands the perspective or the perception.
On expanding the perception, have you seen some of that stuff on awakening the third eye and the pituitary gland and getting rid of the fluoride crystals in your third eye and all that fun stuff? Have you seen that stuff online yet?
No, I haven't seen that stuff online. I'm going to have to check that out.
Okay.
I've heard, well, the fluoride, kind of calcifying the pineal gland, that's something that is supposedly well known. I don't know if the scientific fact behind it.
I feel like that's an area that there should be. I mean, you have a couple, Rick Strassmans or something like that, but not for DMT or under ayahuasca. You'd have, some neurologists, modern neurologists, would be able to check that. I mean, it's not that hard to have a cadaver and open it up and really take a good look at that. It's not something mainstream media wants to talk about, the inside of brains, too much.
It's kind of gooey.
But if that was the case, if there's fluoride crystals or something inside people's brains, then there should be empirical evidence for that, and it should come out to the mainstream. If they're gonna, we get flogged with all kinds of crazy information on the internet. That was one of the more interesting things. They had something called the skatefish oil, which is apparently a supplement you take that helps clear some of that up, so you can clear out your third eye. I tried that for a little while.
How did it taste?
It tastes gross. It's just like eating flax oil or something. I was like, that's interesting. I'll give that a try. It's like $10 or something on Amazon to buy this stuff. I did notice my dreams were more vivid. Like you're dreaming in HD instead of like looking through a pinhole, you're looking through a wide angle camera or something. I don't know if that was a result or not, but my dreamings were there's more colorful. Dreams is what I would say for that, but nothing that's lasted. So I'm a little dissatisfied with that area of trying out something weird in the rabbit hole for myself.
It was kind of like, the first time I took melatonin, for a while when I had like insomnia. It's like, okay, you take melatonin, you'll go right to bed. I had the worst dreams imaginable. like, you know, we're talking, you know, going to school naked type of dreams and making an ass
stressful,
of yourself.
Stressful dreams.
Oh, yeah, no, I just had to stop it after about a week. It's like, fuck this shit. Like, no, I'm just going to have some more milk and I'm going to go to bed. And it still didn't work out too well, but after...
Yeah, the whole, the neural soup of the brain is a really weird place to go. I had, I remember years and years ago, I was working very hard in the summertime doing some construction kind of stuff and reading online and trying to get into a little bit of bodybuilding and things like that. And we were saying, well, take tribulus, like a root herb or whatever, and it helps with your testosterone and helps you heal faster and get your muscles and all this stuff. I'm like, well, it's not a steroid. It's a herbal supplement. Maybe I'll give that a try. And I had taken a bunch of it, and you get that sort of weird realization where, like, I'm angry about things, and I'm like, oh, you get this sort of a strange perspective on yourself. Like, okay, maybe this is testosterone talking. And you come to that sort of first realization if maybe that's, what do they call that, the sugar pill mental perspective or something, but
placebo effect.
Maybe it's the placebo effect, and, you know, maybe the trivial stuff really is making me an angry person or something like that. But it's interesting to come to a realization suddenly, like, oh yeah, I forgot I was taking that supplement. Maybe that's why I'm thinking this way. Or old food turning into dopamines and serotonins and stuff like that in the brain and influencing your mood is it's a weird thing that most people don't talk about. We just went through Thanksgiving, so everybody knows about the turkey drugs and the falling asleep and stuff.
Well, a lot of the... if you have enough turkey and red wine, if you mix those two together, then you fall asleep. If you just have the turkey alone, it takes a lot of turkey to actually have that happen. For the most part, I think it's just people just getting drunk at dinner time and just passing out on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you eat a lot of food, all the blood goes to your stomach.
Where chemistry and consciousness meet is you know, the foreground of for human evolution. And one of the things in this book is they said, well, you know, basically we set all of that, we set a lot of that aside for a long time because I guess it scared a lot of people in the 60s when people started, you know, playing with acid and different kinds of drugs and things like that. And then, you know, Nixon and the anti-drug wars and stuff came in and said, okay, I don't know, we're shutting all this down. This is illegal, that's illegal, this is illegal, that's illegal. And now people have to go get, you know, very special permits and stuff to try to explore consciousness with chemicals. But and then everything's a chemical. All your food is a chemical. And it's all influencing brain chemistry, right? So, but nobody teaches you how to do that for yourself. There's a whole online thing with the nootropics and supplements and brain drugs and Adderalls and, you know, students taking Adderalls and modafinils and stuff to try to get super focused and dialed in. And
you know, there was actually a and I'm not trying to plug Vice, but there was actually a Vice article that I had read, and I'm going to see if I can find the history for that thing.
All this stuff is hitting guys like you and me that spend all our time surfing. I don't think that's new news, but yeah, modafinil. I tried that a couple of times. It was interesting. It definitely helps you focus, dialed into productivity. It gives you a little bit of a headache at the end of the day. I had picked up some of that on I did a all-inclusive trip down to Mexico a little while ago, and when you're going through the airport there, you can pick it up without a prescription. It was
what?
Like $20 or something. I was like, okay,
are you kidding me?
I'll try it. They prescribe it to people with sleep apnea and stuff like that need to work. So it's a pretty, it's a strong drug, but it's not a legal or illicit drug.
One of the side effects that they had mentioned was that the brain plasticity being affected potentially by it. That even because you can be so dialed into what you're doing, that your brain cannot adapt as easily down the road to difficult or different tasks because you're just so used to doing the exact same thing. It's something that you can use to be productive, but not necessarily creative. Which
I'd agree with that.
Well, it's like with any stimulant. If you know, if you're gonna do, you know, if you're gonna do amphetamines or cocaine, you know, you're gonna be very, very, very productive at the one task that you're doing. But if anyone asks you to do anything different, you're gonna freak the hell out.
You're dialed in on one formula or whatever.
Yeah. So you know, that's kind of one of the different aspects if you're dealing with like the stimulants or at least the focus.
I actually think our generation needs something like that. I mean, we've got death by multitasking, and we've got, you know, you're sitting here with three monitors open. You've got, you know, ADD to the extreme, just as I do, and everyone our generation does. It's just there's so many things competing for your attention. But we're sitting here while, you know, the smartphone's going off with, you know, 42 different subscription feeds, and it's just they're all attacking your attention constantly. So to dial in and focus on something is actually a really important skill to have. Either you go there by yourself or you take the drug as the shortcut. You take the drug, you pay the price. You're going to get that headache, or you're going to be dehydrated, or whatever.
You know, heart attack.
You just got to be willing to pay that price. That productivity better be worth it.
Well, just to be able to comment, I see this as one canvas, just with like three different pages open at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, one I don't even look at, one something that we can look at, the other one I can throw on.
You rationalize your ADD however you want, Chris.
Well, you know,
I have the same thing. I'm just teasing.
Well, and then I also have, like, you know, the iPad with the one just to be able to play the intro song and, you know, the, you know.
I think it's going to be really interesting when the augmented reality stuff really hits mainstream, and that's going to be coming out in the next year or two. Maybe some people will be listening to this one day on it, but you'll have the screens will be, well, right in front of your eyes, almost inside your head, if it's done well. And that'll be really interesting for the advertising world and the media consuming world. That'll be an interesting quantum jump in online media. I'm looking forward to that. There's apparently some pretty amazing stuff that's coming out.
I had looked into, and I'm not going to say it was a marketing idea for augmented reality. I'm not going to mention it because if somebody takes my idea and makes a lot of money off of it.
I was actually thinking the same thing. Really, I've got a couple ideas for that. We could make some money there, Chris.
Well, you know what? We're getting into one media world. We'll see about getting into another. The idea for augmented reality, and especially
quick coin a phrase for podcasts, but in augmented reality podcast. Need to recoin it.
Learn some cool shit in 3D.
Okay. Needs work, but we'll take that for now.
You know, it's kind of the same thing. It's like you ask a comedian to be funny, he's going to look at you sideways and smack you upside the head. You ask an advertising guy to, you know, Chris, come up with a tagline for this. It's like, motherfucker, do you know how long it takes to come up with a tagline? Like, you're talking months and months sometimes, at least according to some, you know, I'm better than most.
You're
I can
just
do it in
weeks. Some modafinil and focus on it for a second, okay?
Oh, shit, I just need to get drunk, then I'm good. Just a little bit of
creativity
scotch.
Creativity flows, you know, stop thinking about your own problems, start thinking about the world.
You know, just give me a glass of scotch on the rocks and a good cigarette on a nice patio with the world going by so I could just kind of escape and, you know, let my mind go free, then yes, that's kind of how it works. But with drugs like modafinil, it's like, okay.
I'm sure there's creative drugs out there. No, I'm not encouraging you. Just saying.
This is being uploaded to the intertubes, so it's the interweb. You know what? I think we're looking at about... You know, I think we can go into our final words almost soon. So.
Yeah, did we miss any topics we wanted to throw in there under the bus?
I think we got pretty much everything in there. We touched a little bit on the ancient history. I'd like to be able to go a little bit more into that, but...
Well, on the finance side, I was going to throw in, going to note here, debt weapons.
Debt weapons.
It's an exciting leveraging tool.
Debt weapons, like...
We can talk
like,
about that again soon.
You know what?
Like using your credit card to buy assets that you turn over in a shorter period of time than you have to pay off your credit card. But you
don't
leverage debt. Or you leverage other people's money to buy assets and then sell those and then pay off the credit card. Sort of like a...
You know, we have to have one of these every fucking week now. It's like, you know, Alex's financial tips at the top of the show.
I dug into the finance world because I'm like, okay, I have to put enlightenment on hold, and I got to figure out how to automate all this financial stuff for myself and systematize it. Then I can go back in and we'll go tomb raiding and exploring ancient cultures and stuff like that. Tomb raiders have a lot of money. You got to, you know, get all those toys and plane trips and go explore the world. But first, you have to build.
We need the money to be able
to build the empire to do all that stuff.
Oh, that's the first step, as it were.
Or or we start some sort of program.
We started a
program. We'll talk about that off air.
Okay, that's good enough. So, yeah, going into the last 5 or 10 minutes of the show, I'd like to thank you all for listening in tonight. We started a little bit late this evening, but again, obviously, tomorrow afternoon, so after 12 p.m., you'll be able to download this podcast from denoflore.com. In addition, I believe Alex will be back next week. We'll see if we can get him back in the studio as a co-host on Wednesday for Denver Michaels. We were supposed to have him this week. Unfortunately, a scheduling conflict on my part had us push everything back. Actually, this week's been pretty well completely fucked for me. So I do apologize, but we still brought you a show, and we will bring you one at least once a week. Next week is a double episode, just to give you guys a heads up. Hacker X, unfortunately, is going to be pushed back for, what's the term?
Help the time being.
For the time being, due to non-disclosure agreements being in the way, unfortunately, he cannot give interviews. So if we get him on, fantastic, but it may not actually be hacker-related, or we'll ask him how to hack a toaster to make toast from afar. But for Denver Michaels next week, we will be talking anything from Sasquatch to his
toast brought to you by the Internet of Things. Tune in next time. Same toast channel.
Oh man, I'm not even going to be able to get to the end of the show for this. Okay. For Denver Michaels, we're going to be talking cryptozoology, water monsters, south of the border. We're going to be talking ancient civilizations and cultures, anything from that to Sasquatch, as well as, just anything else that just kind of pops into our heads. It's a free-form show, and we are ending our third episode. So, Alex, anything? I would say that you passed the interview.
Good. Good. So looking forward to coming back, and
we don't pay anything.
Chipping away.
I can pay you in scotch. That's pretty much
at the Mountain of Mysteries.
At scotch of the Mountain of Mysteries. Yes, we will have to do that at some point.
There's going to be a lot of navel gazing, staring up at the stars after the show.
Oh well, that's
a good, what scotch is for.
That is what scotch is for, and having at least a good. What time is it? We have time for a cigar. Holy shit, it's almost 11. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, I think that's enough rambling on my part for today. So I would...
thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being on, and we'll hope to see you next week and making this more of a regular, permanent, semi-permanent thing. I need somebody to play off of. That's kind of being the one-man show is hard. You need the two. You need the one intelligence.
Stream of consciousness. Okay,
Let's finish. Okay.
Let's wrap it up there, Chris.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Next Wednesday, that is Wednesday. What is next Wednesday?
20th?
20th.
13 plus 7.
13 plus 7. Let me just see here. I do apologize. I should actually get this stuff ready next time. I'm very bad at the dates. Wednesday, the 19th of October, is going to be Denver Michaels. We're going to bring him on at about 8:30. The 20th, I have the Ottawa Paranormal Society.
We are Thursday today, by mistake.
Yeah, we are Thursday today. Ottawa Paranormal Society, it's going to be our quote-unquote Halloween episode. We're going to be talking about basically their paranormal experiences and a few of their cases. They're one of the biggest teams of their kind in the city, and we think you will all have a blast. And to finish out the month, we also have Ankit Verma, who is a college friend of mine who's been making waves in the movie review world with his own podcast, and we're going to be talking to him about popular culture, advertising, marketing, and just any cool shit we can think up of. So watch out for November's schedule soon. I'll have that up as quickly as possible. This is all kind of new to me, so it takes me a while to get all of the assets and information up, but we're working on a system, and we'll have that going for you. Once again, this is Chris George Zuger signing off, and this Alex Francis
signing off.
And we will see you next week. Thanks.